Please be advised this podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature. It's not appropriate for children.
Children's author who stabbed a pensioner to death because she was craving cigarettes has been jailed for 13 years. The victim's grieving family say that's nowhere near long enough.
Zvonimir Petrovsky's grieving family left court questioning the sentence handed down to his killer. Anna Hornshaw became enraged with her pensioner housemate over cigarette money. She viciously stabbed the 67-year-old 22 times with a boning knife.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
This week, part two of Mary and Katie's story. They are the mother and sister, respectively, of Anna, the girl the headlines screamed, killed a man for cigarettes. The brutal attack that happened that night in the suburban flat that Anna shared with her victim Johnny was the climax of decades of worsening mental illness. Anna's family believed they tried everything to prevent her from hurting herself or anyone else, but were badly let down by Australia's mental health system. I would urge you to go back and listen to part one of this episode if you haven't already, but here's a reminder of where we're up to in this heartbreaking story.
It was just amazing. Like, she didn't look any different from any other kid, but she was labeled as a weirdo and a loser in kindergarten. There was something, looking back, something different about her brain. Mm. And she just could not fit into childhood society. And it wouldn't have, you know, there were never any birthday party invitations for her. Aww. No girly sleepovers.
It's really
hard. And it wouldn't have been so bad if she didn't care, but her heart was just broken over and over again. And it was so hard for us to see that at home we tried to make her happy all the time. You know, we just tried to make up for these things. And now we wonder, by giving her that instant gratification, were we already setting her up for addiction when she was a child? She would be crying in the night, you know, no one likes me. And we did try to give her practical solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, we tried and tried, try this, try that. And we took her to a course for anxious children, but nothing seemed to work. So we just wanted to make her happy. So I'd be like, well, how about I make you some brownies, like at midnight? And she'd go, yeah, that would make me happy. So,
yeah.
You know, I'd be doing that. I just wanted her to smile and look happy. So
it was a real cycle of Anna, you know, displaying this unhappiness, and then mum and dad buying her things or doing things for her.
She heard ghosts speaking to her. She heard them breathing in her ear. And, you know, I just would sit with her until she went to sleep to try and help her through that. But now I wonder, was that an early manifestation of hearing voices?
What it did was it created a family dynamic where I became, you know, a de facto third parent. Mm-hmm. And that dynamic has just continued in perpetuity. And so there's only three of us, you know, and we all have to really pitch in, and we all have to do everything we can to make her as happy as we can at home. Ever since Anna's been a child, there's been a feeling of, like, if we don't support her and if we don't give her what she needs, what's she going to do? We still feel that she hasn't been properly diagnosed. Mum became more and more and more just Anna's sort of servant. And Dad and I were just sort of proxies. Nobody challenged Anna. The threat of her killing herself became more and more of a realistic possibility as time went on.
We thought it would happen. We thought it was inevitable. We definitely thought she was going to die. All of us did. We also called the police. And I was crying on the other end with the police saying, are we allowed, can we physically restrain her to keep her from leaving the house? And they said, no, you can't do that, that's assault.
this is when we felt like we were being failed by the system. We felt like we were getting no support at all, despite, you know, Mum using all of her resources, all of her journalistic skills, you know, all of her education skills to try to find help for Anna. We couldn't find any appropriate help. We felt like we were just had been abandoned by the system.
We pick up the story with Anna living back at her parents' house. Her rages are as unpredictable as they are frightening, and she's routinely bringing scary strangers back to the family home. Her mother is frequenting sex shops, buying Anna synthetic weed, which exacerbates her mental illness, but she threatens suicide if Mary refuses.
Should I describe what to me was like maybe the worst day?
Mm.
It was early in the morning and Anna was already drinking. By this stage, she was afraid to leave the house many times. She was mentally ill, so she wasn't consistent. But at this time, she was scared to leave the house. So John had agreed to supply her with light beer and one carafe of wine at night as a sort of harm minimization approach.
Mm-hmm.
So she was drinking her light beer but suddenly something just snapped in her. And thank God John and I were both in the kitchen. She just grabbed a butcher knife and just plunged it towards her chest.
Her own chest.
Yeah, oh. And John held it, but she's a strong girl. You wouldn't think she looks fragile, but she's very strong. And she was screaming at the top of her lungs, I want to kill myself. And he was holding back the knife. I rang her doctor that we totally respect, who's been her doctor since she was 15 and had anorexia. I said, what should we do, Dr. Deb? And I said, can you hear her screaming? She said, well, call the mental health line. So I did. And it said, your call is important to us. Please stay on the line. And I'm like,
oh, my God.
What am I going to do, Deb? And she said, you'll just have to call the police. And I said, I don't want to call the police. They shoot mentally ill people.
Yeah.
And she said, well, you'll have to. Just hang up the phone and call the police. So I did. And they were fantastic. And we actually heard a siren in the background, which didn't turn out to be that particular car. But when Anna heard the siren, she suddenly became good. She switched into good
Interesting,
Anna.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. How she can switch between.
Yeah.
Wow.
Dad had been using, he later said he was at the limits of his strength.
To hold her down.
Yeah, yeah.
But when the police actually got there, she apologized to them. I'm sure you've got better things to do. And I just described briefly the last, you know, couple of months, and they said, you did exactly the right thing. And this policewoman was so nice, and they called an ambulance, and so they were there for maybe an hour waiting for the ambulance,
and they stayed with you.
I was just pouring out my fears and what had happened to this policewoman, who also had a background in psychology, and she was so understanding. I just wanted to keep her. I was like, oh, can you just live here, please?
Because yes.
You've got a gun.
Yeah. You can control her.
Yeah.
Hope is a very, can be a terrible thing with a kid like this, because I found that one of the worst things was hoping and then the terrible disappointment when nothing comes of it.
Because they would take her to the hospital and the hospital would have to do a psychiatric assessment.
That day I had hope because the policewoman / psychologist said, now she'll be in the adult mental health system because we're going to take her, we're going to admit, you know.
Yep, admit her.
We're going to go with her to the psych unit. We're going to put her in and she'll be in the mental health system. And she said, this girl needs to be in a hospital long term. She needs to have proper medication. And then she can have good days. She said to me, she can have times when she functions well, but she's always going to have to be monitored very carefully. And I thought that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And they couldn't actually get an ambulance. So and Anna didn't want to go in the police car. So they said, okay, you promised to be good? She said, yes, we can take her. John and I could take her in the car and the police would follow behind. So on the freeway, she tries to jump out of the back of the car.
Oh, no.
Then the police were like, get in the car or we're going to handcuff you, Anna. So they took her. And so we sat all day with her at the emergency room. And it became apparent that this person was going to assess her to see if she should be admitted to the psych ward. And at the end of the day, the person came to talk to me, and I could not believe it. I was saying, you know, this girl needs to be in the hospital. She's if we take her home, she's going to die. And this woman just said, well, I'm sorry, you know, she's not bad enough.
Oh.
I mean, that's not the word
she used. How bad do you have to be? I don't know.
That's what she was saying.
Yeah, and that set up a pattern of that happening again and again and again, that same day basically repeating itself. Each time mum begging them to take her, each time them saying she's not bad enough.
Sometimes
her
she
home.
Herself begged to be taken.
Yeah. Mm. She said to the, on one occasion, she said to the person doing the assessment, I'm having homicidal thoughts and I can't get rid of them. They're taking over my brain. I'm having trouble thinking about anything else. I don't know, you know, whether I can hold myself back from acting on it. And so she said that. She didn't say that to us, but she said that to them. And
she later told us about
yeah.
it. She said, I'm suicidal and I'm homicidal. And according to her, I mean, I didn't hear this from the actual person, but Anna has told us about it on many occasions. She is very angry about this particular incident. She said, I need to be admitted. I'm
yeah.
suicidal and homicidal. Please admit me. And they said, according to Anna, they said, if we admitted everyone who says that, we'd have a lot of people here.
Oh, my God.
The bottom line is they, for whatever reason, they would look at Anna. Anna was intelligent. She was always articulate, you know, right until the very end, even when she was psychotic, even, you know, when she was drunk until the point where she literally couldn't talk anymore, she was always articulate. And they would look at our family, I suppose, yeah. and we just didn't fit the mold for someone, you know, a family that was harbouring this person that could potentially be a danger to society. But we knew it. Like, we always thought Anna would kill herself or be killed, but towards the end, as she was starting to exhibit violent behaviour as well, Dad and I both started worrying that she would, we thought she'd do something to us. That started being a worry that she would kill herself, be killed, and then that was the additional worry that she would hurt somebody else. Mm-hmm. Because
and I never thought that could happen personally. I didn't think she'd hurt somebody, but John did.
And we've had some famous examples mm-hmm. in the last couple of years of young people murdering family members.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what John was
certainly
afraid
when
of.
ICE is involved.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and
yeah.
And, you know, she was being manipulated by ICE addicts. So at this stage, she was in and out of psychosis a lot. And when she would be in psychosis, she would be ringing me up saying, you know, Dad's not who he says he is. And, you know, don't listen to a word he says. And he's somebody else. And I've got it all figured out. And Mum and Dad are evil. Katie, do not listen to them. You know, if you go over to their side, you know, then you'll just be one of them. And I remember being really, really careful to try to remain on Anna's like side of her delusion
yeah.
that was, you know, the good side, because she had put Mum and Dad and, you know, the FBI, even though they're in America, and the CIA, and they were all after her and they were all part of this horrible conspiracy. And
when she went up to some guys on the street one day and said, I know what you're planning.
Mm. Yeah, she would Lebanese approach random people on the street.
She thought there was this conspiracy to... You know, she was.
So what happened on the day? Let's go forward to the day that Johnny died. So she's living in shared accommodation with a bunch of older men, some of whom are taking advantage of her. But Johnny is like a safe haven.
Yeah.
He's a
yeah.
lovely.
Well, I wouldn't say that the guys in the house never took advantage of her.
Right. Okay.
It was other people on the train, et cetera.
Mm, right. Okay.
The guys in the house were amazingly patient with her because they had called the police on. I know of at least two occasions, and I think on a third, to say that she was violent and assaulting them.
Wow.
My fear was that, I mean, I don't know what was happening then, because once we kicked her out, she said, you know, well, you can't tell me how to live anymore because, you know, if you don't let you live at your house, I'm going to do what I want. But we came to this agreement over the months when she started actually being nice to me, and that I was allowed to give her one piece of advice at a time, but that's it. So, like, I don't actually, and I didn't ask questions, so I don't actually know what the assaults were that they called the police for.
Mm-hmm.
I know that she did ring me one night sobbing, saying, I hit Johnny. I hit him with his stick because he had his two walking sticks, and she was really upset. And I said,
he was very frail.
I said, if you get that angry, just walk away. Go out of the house for a while. That was my piece of advice that day.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the police had come because she'd been violent towards these guys in the house. My fear was that one day they would get sick of calling the police and just retaliate, you know, and say, you know, we've had enough of this.
Mm-hmm.
She used to get mad at them because they wouldn't clean up the squalid place and she wanted them to clean. But so we weren't there on the day. I had seen her a couple of days before and, you know, tried to help her clean up and taken her, for appointments, and Johnny as well. 2 days before, Johnny could barely get around, but I had helped him out to my car and taken him to some business that he needed to do at the post office and taken him to Centrelink. And we'd had a chat, you know, as I said, you know, I really respected him. I liked him a lot. And he was always giving me so much positive reinforcement. You're such a good mother. You're such a good mama. And a mama, he used to call me. So I'd seen her and Johnny and another guy that I was quite fond of in the house a couple of days before. So we don't know.
Well, tell me from your perspective, what was the first you heard about?
It was on the Sunday. I call it Black Sunday. So we didn't even know what happened on the Saturday night.
Right.
I got a call coming through another call, you know, when that happens on your mobile phone.
Yeah.
So I rang the police. It was from a policeman. You know, this was not a shock with her. You know, we'd had many, many calls from policemen by this time. I was like, oh, what did she do now? Mm. I actually didn't... on that particular call, I didn't think she would have killed herself because she had a lot of reasons to live at that time. She had gathered up, mainly partly because she had some kittens with her, and she just loved them. So I thought, what's she done? I thought, so the policeman said, are you close with your daughter? And I said, yes. And he said, you know, she was living with some older men. And I said, yes. And he said, well... that the elderly man, there's been an assault, and unfortunately he's passed away. And I just started screaming, and John came in. I was in the bedroom. I remember John came in and, like, what has happened? And I just screamed, you know, she's killed Johnny. And the policeman said, do you want to speak to her? And I said, no, I can't talk to her. First time in my life I didn't actually want to talk to her on the phone.
Mm.
I just couldn't believe, you know, that that's what she'd done. But we didn't know the details we knew she's, I mean, at first I thought she must have hit him with a stick again and he had a heart attack. That's what I thought. So during those first hours, I didn't know how he had died. It was only when I started communicating with a pro bono lawyer that she had that first day. And I said, oh, that must have been what happened. And the lawyer just said, no, Mary, that's not what happened. That's how I realized that she had done something to Johnny. She stabbed him. But we didn't know that's all we knew. And subsequently, when Anna was in prison, I asked her once if she wanted to talk about it, and she said no. So we didn't know the details of what happened until the sentencing hearing 14 months later.
Hmm.
We heard the details just along with the media in the courtroom.
But Mum was always able to maintain a level of denial with Anna. Like, Mum didn't want to accept when Anna had started taking ice. Like, it was pretty obvious to me that she was, just from her behaviour and suddenly being awake all night and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And also I'd, you know, had some experiences with these drugs myself, so I could tell. But even now, Mum and I dispute about this. Mum will always say, no, she wasn't doing ice. So, you know, this is my version of events.
I know she did it sometimes.
But I think she started it long before Mum thinks she did. And that's just an example anyway, that Mum was always able to maintain a level of denial about Anna. And one of the things with Mum's denial was that, as Mum says, she never thought that Anna would hurt anybody. And Dad and I were pretty worried about that. And then the day that I got the call from Mum saying Anna's killed Johnny, I immediately thought that she would have stabbed him. Because she'd talked about that. She'd talked about fantasizing about that.
Not with Johnny.
No, not with Johnny. But
there was the butcher's knife incident at home that was obviously just a thing that was in her mind.
And I mean, I knew, I was putting two and two together. I mean, I knew she didn't have a gun. And I wasn't surprised when I found out that, you know, she'd stabbed him multiple times. that it had been basically, you know, a violent rage. But Mum really, really struggled with that. She couldn't believe it. She couldn't, you know, accept it. She didn't want to know. So there was always...
I never wanted to know the details, but I had to be there in the courtroom to hear them.
Because I knew the details by that stage, but Mum only found them out in the court. She did a pretty good job, Mum did, of shielding herself from that day and from the details. And Dad and I had our eyes a little bit wider open by that stage. And Anna, at that stage, for me and Dad, had become a really scary figure. And that's something I did want to talk about is I was frightened of her. Dad was frightened of her. She was really scary. Like, she would, you know, come in, her eyes would be wild, she'd be hysterical, she'd be disheveled, her clothes would be, you know, covered in dirt, she'd be smelly. You know, not all the time, but quite often that's how she'd present. And she could snap at any point. So her good was basically her being manic. So if she was happy, she'd be manic, and you'd just have this sense at any second that she could snap. And you didn't want to be the one to push the button, you know. So you'd be tiptoeing around her, agreeing with everything she said, being really careful. But eventually you'd say something without even meaning to, and then she could just snap and start just, you know, yelling at you and screaming at you, and it was a really frightening experience. And I mean, I want to be clear that that was Anna at her very, very worst, and that's not who she is. And that wasn't her, that was psychotic her. But I mean, that I just think that's something that's sort of interesting is that... at that time, I was finding it very, very difficult to have any empathy whatsoever towards Anna. I was
really you and your dad were obviously right to be afraid.
Yeah. And Mum and I would have disagreements at that stage So, Mum was always a mum. Mum always, even at Anna's absolute, absolute worst, saw her somehow managed to see the little girl in there.
Yeah.
So that was a difference.
So to sit, I can't imagine the, I'm going to use the worst word I reckon in the English language, the shame of sitting in a courtroom surrounded by people and hearing the minute details of your daughter viciously murdering somebody. What's your recollection of that day and that time?
Well, I wanted to leave.
Of course.
I just wanted, in fact, I remember... hanging on to Katie, remember, physically that day and saying, I might just go up and, like, leave for this bit.
Yes, of course.
But I wanted to be there for Anna. I thought that's going to upset her worse because we didn't want her to lose it that day and start, you know, having a fit in the court. So I just sat and listened to it, but it was very difficult. And, I didn't want to hear it, but I had to.
Do you wish you hadn't? Or does that ever cross your mind?
Well, to be honest... I'm glad I did because I now know that Johnny was probably already unconscious when she stabbed him. Yeah. And before that I had nightmares about Johnny seeing this girl come towards him that he trusted and loved in his own way. So in a way, the scenario that I imagined was not as bad as what probably really happened because... So we think he was already unconscious.
What happened? What is the truth behind the woman murders man for cigarettes?
So do you want me to basically just go through the... So, you know, obviously we weren't there that day, but and we have never completely discussed it with Anna, but Anna basically doesn't dispute the fact that essentially... Johnny had gone out that day. He'd gone out drinking with his family and they had brought him home. And when he returned, Anna was in a bit of a state. We don't know why. Mum thinks that she wasn't using ice at that time. You know, she might have been drunk or, you know, whatever. She was in one of her very out of it, possibly. They said she wasn't psychotic, did they? So she was... she was agitated, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. I think she'd been fighting.
And she needed things. She always wanted people to look after her, and Johnny wasn't looking after her properly that day.
Mm. Yeah, so he returned and she wanted him to buy her cigarettes. He had been dishing her out to her a lot of money at this stage, and he refused. And she...
He said he'd get him the next day, but I'm not doing it now at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
Well, this is what you never did. Isn't it interesting? Yeah, because you guys had created this environment where she demanded and she got because you were scared. And again, I'm not accusing you. You were right to be scared.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But it's absolutely true. Yeah. She was not used to somebody saying no to her.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how many times she'd had that experience. Maybe not that many times.
Yeah.
And so, you know, according to the reports, she asked to see the money in the wallet. He showed her the money to show, set, you know, say, I will get them for you. I've got the money, but I'm not going to get them for you now. And you know, apparently she then, or according to the court reports, she snatched the money and went into a rage. And the first thing that she did apparently was punch him so that he fell down unconscious. So that's what we were relieved about.
Okay.
Was that he didn't have any awareness. And she obviously went into...
I prefer
into,
not to...
No, you don't go into all the details.
Okay, yeah, that's fine, yeah.
I understand.
And that's available. I mean, if people want to read the court reports, they're publicly available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The judgment. We thought the judge was so fair.
Okay.
We were absolutely thrilled with her analysis of the situation because she could put together all the dots that people couldn't do before because every incident was treated separately. They didn't see the pattern of violence emerging. But the judge could because she could subpoena all those records.
Yeah.
And so you're here with us today, which is a time that you would normally be visiting with Anna. I know that you've missed a visit today.
Oh, no, we put it for further back. We made it at 4:30.
Oh, great. So you're still going today.
We're seeing you today at 4:30. Yep.
Awesome. Yep. How many times a week do you visit Anna?
Twice.
Twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
Or she gets three visits a week and usually we'll do two of them or sometimes we'll do the three between me and Mum and Dad.
Oh, so Dad's back?
Yeah.
Dad's still, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Dad visits as well.
Oh, he's very faithful. Yeah. Every week he visits. Yeah. And they, you know, Anna adores him.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, if there is a ray of light in this story, it is that... Anna's doing really well.
Yeah.
In jail.
Incredibly, yeah.
How's she going? What's happened?
Well, the thing about it is, as I said in the article, I always felt that the only way that she was ever going to make improvements was if she was held somewhere involuntarily and basically forced to stop taking drugs and forced to... change the way that she was operating because the system that had been set up on the outside, that toxic system where she would demand things and get them, got her to where she was. And there was no way of breaking that system on the outside. It had just got to the point where we didn't know how to fix it. Mm. And so there wasn't anywhere available on the outside that was sort of involuntary residential care. But when she was eventually provided that care in prison, it was pretty amazing how quickly she started to show improvements.
Immediately.
Yeah.
The first day I went in to visit her, it was like I'd forgotten what a beautiful voice she had.
Oh.
Because for years she'd been slowing down and slurring and she was very flat. And you don't realize it when it happens gradually.
Yeah.
But... the first time I saw her in prison, she comes out of that door with the green jumpsuit that they have to wear for visits. She grabbed me and hugged me and started crying. I realized she hadn't cried in a long time. Mm. You know, her emotions were so flat and controlled by substances that, and she was crying. And then she started talking, and she had all these tones, and her voice was back to being her own voice. I hadn't missed it, but when I heard it again, I thought, "That's amazing." You know, she sometimes speaks softly, and the color and tones were back in her voice. That was amazing, and because she in prison, and I don't want to sound like we're happy about it because you know someone died because of this, but she's getting all the things that we begged for that we knew she needed. She's got proper medication given to her every day. She's got sleep. She's got proper nutrition. She's got access to exercising and she's got friends.
But most importantly, she's got boundaries.
Yeah, it's rules and regulations.
This was the only way that she was ever going to have any... She needed boundaries enforced and the only way it was going to happen was going to be prison.
Wow.
Because it had got to that point. And just knowing for her, I feel like knowing that if she screws up, there will be consequences is actually really reassuring for her. And
she has screwed up and she has got consequences and she's trying hard not to let that happen again.
Mm. Because on the outside, she didn't have any walls to sort of bounce up against. And I feel like, not to get into the kind of psychology of it all, but I really feel like that was her major problem, was that she always needed boundaries, but they were never in place. And then now that she's got them in prison, that's...
But also she couldn't do life. She hated people asking her, why don't you have a license? Why don't you have a job?
Yep.
All that pressure's off her.
Yep.
She doesn't have to pay rent. She doesn't have to worry about keeping her Centrelink going.
Yep.
And she's very well liked at the prison. The officers often tell me, you know, she's always respectful. She's such an intelligent girl, you know, and... She's doing good things there. She helps with the younger girls coming in. Well, she's been there long enough to see the cycle of, you know, girls going out and coming back in. They're really happy to see her. Some of them are really young, you know, 18, 19 years old. And they're readmitted to the prison, and they see Anna like, Anna. You know, she helps them when they're coming off on ice. You know, she says, what can I do for you? I'll make you a sandwich. And they say, yes, Anna, well, like a sandwich.
She's like Auntie Anna. Yeah.
What sentence did she receive? How long is she in jail for? Is she in jail for the rest of her life?
Oh, no, she got it because the judge decided that even though psychosis did not cause her to murder him, there were a lot of her mental condition contributed to what she did. So her lawyer was really happy with the sentence. He said it's one of the... You know, it's on the lighter end of murder. 17 years, 13 years non-parole.
Are you worried about her coming home?
Yes.
If she's so happy and...
We worry about it all the time. Like, because 13 years is, even though it's a long time, it's like a definite... Before we had the trial, I mean, the sentencing hearing, there wasn't a trial because she pled guilty. But before that, there was an 18-month period when, I guess we just sort of
envisioned
that she would be there forever, you know, and that felt really reassuring. And then when we found out that she's going to be out in 11 years because she's done two already, that is scary.
We hope that she can learn from this, but people might find it interesting that I think all the parents of anyone like this has PTSD.
You know,
I can be triggered by going past at the Brody Shopping Centre, a toilet where she was found unconscious and had to be taken home by an ambulance, you know. I can just, But one thing that Katie and John and I have all had nightmares where Anna suddenly appears in the house.
Yeah.
And we are like, oh, my God, how did you get out of prison?
Yeah.
And then when we woke up, we're just like, oh, thank God, she's in prison.
Yeah, she's
safe.
She's
still there.
We're safe.
Yeah.
You wouldn't. I think a lot of people would, like, find that pretty surprising. They'd think, you know,
listening to you for an hour. No, not at all.
The worst place your kid could be is a prison, and we're like, oh, God, she's still there, thank goodness.
Does she want to get out? Do you think she's scared of coming?
She's scared of two. She says she wouldn't leave. She says she'd go buy herself a pack of cigarettes, have a cigarette, go back inside. If she could leave, that's all she'd do, and then she'd just go back. The girls there refer to it as home. They say, oh, I'm back home now. And one thing there's just two things that want to make sure that I don't forget to talk about.
Yeah.
First of all, just before we get too, you know, far away from the incident, I just want to make it clear that, like, we know that what Anna did was a terrible thing, and we want her, and we thought she deserved to be punished to the full extent of the law. We didn't feel like she should get any special treatment.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really dealt with that ourselves either. So when you talk about the shame of what she did and everything, at the moment, I think that the way our family is dealing with that is just, we haven't gone there yet. I haven't allowed myself really to properly think about it. I can talk about it, but I'm not letting my brain really go there. And that's the same with Mum and Dad. And so we haven't reconciled.
Can I just say something about that? I just keep it. one of my mental health tools that I learned, because I've struggled with my mental health a lot. And it's only in the past few years that I think I've really, it's improved a lot. And one technique I use is I visualize my mind as a house, like a beautiful double-story house. And there's rooms, and I can put some things just in a room and close the door. Mm-hmm. It's not locked. It's not, it's accessible to me, but I don't have to go into that room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I've done with my daughter being a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's in that room. And someday I might need to open the door, but that's closed. And it doesn't mean that I don't respect Johnny and grieve for him. I talk to Johnny a lot in my head, pray for him, saying I'm so sorry for, and I feel that he's with me a lot, but I don't go into my daughter is a murderer room. But there's this other room where she's in prison doing really well, and that's how I deal with it.
So because I took a little bit of flack with the article because I think that I didn't make that clear enough.
Really?
It was just a few comments. It wasn't, I shouldn't call it take a bit of flack. I mean, I'm sure.
People always find a way to criticise anything.
Well,
and I thought it was an amazingly balanced, and you were
beautiful very,
piece.
Very clear to pay respect to Johnny and all of that stuff. I don't think there was any apologist stuff going on here at all.
No.
Well, a few people said that, like, that we... I just want to make it clear that we believe that Anna needed to be punished. You know, she did a horrible thing. She deserves to be punished. And we, and then leading on from that, the fact that what can we do, because we can't bring back Johnny, we can't fix the pain that this family is going through. And I think that maybe they might be wondering, well, why are you guys out there talking about it? And one of the reasons that we want to talk about it isn't just for us, it's for Johnny, families like Johnny's as well, because the only thing that's unique about our situation is the thing that happened at the end of it was, you know, so sort of salacious. But there's families, you know, all, thousands and thousands of families all over Australia going through the exact same thing we did.
Yeah.
And they feel like they're being failed by the system, and they feel like they've been abandoned and there's no support for them, and they're desperate. And since writing the article, so many people have commented or written to me in some capacity.
I was going to ask that, if people were reaching out to you who were scared that this is going to happen with one of their kids.
Absolutely.
Things like, you know, this could be our daughter, this could be our son. And one mother said, you know, my daughter sounds so much like yours. And there's no help. And people are exhausted. She said the thing, you know, that you don't think of things like sleep deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were constantly getting woken up by, either we couldn't sleep because she was away and we were waiting for the phone call, or she was there. Even though we had a steel box from Bunnings in which we locked the knives, all the sharp objects, the hand sanitizer, the perfume, because she would eat. One time we found her unconscious with her lips red because she'd eaten hand sanitizer and mouthwash.
For the alcohol content.
Yeah.
Even though we had all those things locked up, she would still, we'd wake up in the night. One time I woke up with this thump, 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 hearing it. And I got up and she was just beating her head rhythmically against the wall until it was bleeding.
Or with the tomato tin. Or
another
with,
time she got a tin out and she was hitting herself with that. So, and that's what other people were saying, you know, we're just exhausted, you know, we can't sleep. And this one woman said, it could be my daughter. And she said at the end, I only hope that she commits a non-violent crime so she can get into prison.
And people, you know, people are writing in these comments just saying, we've got nothing left. We've just got nothing left. And, you know, people are saying things that you would never, ever think that people would say about their own kids, just saying maybe they'd be better off if they would just die in a way that one of the things you're afraid of is that they'll die in this really horrible way. Like, you're hoping, you get to the stage where you're just hoping that they'll at least have a good death, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what these families are saying, that maybe it's better if their child just does a bit too much heroin one day and just doesn't come back.
Peacefully
and
goes
that's
away.
Where people are at. And
I can understand that. And it's beyond disturbing to think that a woman could tell healthcare professionals that she had homicidal feelings and not be taken seriously and murder someone.
Yeah.
It's beyond, we don't want to think that we can live in a society where that can happen. So for that alone, it's valuable. To me, that's something for Johnny and for Johnny's family.
And
he didn't have to die.
We want exactly, and we want to speak for other families of at the prison. Mm-hmm. We meet beautiful families there, and through the ones that have written to Katie, because not everyone has our skills of articulation and our platform to, as writers, and we want to be a voice for them as well.
Yeah,
some of my close friends have said, you know, oh, you should be keep. Why can't you keep this a secret? I mean, not in so many words, but like, well, it's not a secret. It's been splashed all over the media anyway.
Yeah,
and we want to
tell our side of the story, and we want to
show Anna and Johnny as the people they were. And you know, what's the use trying to keep it a secret?
And you're a voice for, as you say, people who don't have the resources. Yeah. I really hope that some influential people listen to this episode. You know, politicians who can. Really,
our mental health system is a disaster.
It's frightening.
We just saw footage a couple of days ago of a woman in a isolation room who died of head injuries from her own, you know, from falling over and banging her head against
and
the wall
and
the floor.
Apparently, she was walking up and down the aisles with feces smeared all over
her
body.
Yeah.
And they were basically just saying, "Get back in your room." And you can't blame the individuals because
we don't blame
systemic problems.
I don't even blame the nurses in that situation. No. I think, how does a system get to a point where
do you think it's too big? Like, people go, it's too big, we can't do anything, let's just hope it never happens to us. Because I feel it's very emotional, this interview, because you think in your head, what the hell would I do if this happens to my daughter?
And do you know what else?
There's a likelihood there's going to be mental health issues with people, in life.
I think also, thank God for your room in your house of your mind, because shame keeps people quiet.
Yeah.
So if you can put that aside and not be crippled by shame, then you can speak out and you can tell the truth and you can help others.
Yeah, I hope so. And if politicians do listen to this, one thing I'd like to say to the government is, if you expect, you know, fair enough, there aren't any more institutions. I mean, I don't know, you know, we could debate about whether that's good or bad. But if you expect us as parents to look after these mentally ill people, at least give us some respite sometimes. Like when that woman at the hospital said to me, just take her home, I just felt like saying, we need a break.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, just 3 or 4 days so I can
sleep.
Sit down with my husband and have a glass of wine and a conversation. We couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, our whole life was just sucked up.
Yeah.
And we just needed a break.
I just didn't know how Mum and Dad kept going. I just didn't. No, they had to. They didn't have a choice. But, you know, by the end, it was just constant for them. It was round the clock, just Anna bashing herself over the head, Anna screaming, Anna threatening suicide, Anna, you know, whatever, she's gone and you know, they're trying to look for her. There wasn't a single minute that went by that it wasn't just hyper arousal.
What have I got to look forward to?
Yeah.
You know, just coming home to chaos.
And at that stage, they didn't know that that for so many families, this just continues forever, you know?
And those are the kind of families I want to help. You know, there's people out there now going through the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who's helping them? Yeah. Where's their respite for this unending cycle of trying to keep your kids safe?
And
if the government expects us to do that.
There's also sort of, I guess, there's love and respect for families with kids with disabilities. Unless it's a mental illness, in which case there's a lot of fear and a lot of not wanting to know.
There is. And even, you know, we were supported by our closest friends, but even our closest friends, like my friends, when they read the article, they all sort of got in touch and went, I just didn't have any idea. And I sort of said, well, I was trying to tell you at the time, but I think that there's a level of switching off and there is a level of, well, there's so much stigma around mental illness. And I think when somebody's trying to talk about it, there is a level from, you know, the person that's hearing it of sort of switching off and basically just kind of saying, well, that's your family's problem. That stuff stays inside a family and you cope with it. And that's why we're trying to, you know, we're being told now by our friends, don't talk about it. Don't go on a podcast and talk about it. You know, just keep it to yourselves. Well, that's
not by everyone,
but a couple of people. But how's that going to change anything? Then it's just going to keep continuing, you know, as it has been. And I just want to make the connection that I'm hoping that through this advocacy that Johnny then didn't die in vain. At least he died for something, you know. I don't know if that would be any comfort to his family, but at least then he could have some kind of legacy, even if it's just a tiny little, even if it's just the people that read my article and the people that listen to this podcast, that at least something comes out of his death, and it just isn't totally senseless, you know.
I'd also like to say that I'm writing a book about all this.
Good.
Great.
You know, I've had 16 books published already, and mostly for kids, but this is an adult memoir. And, Katie, any proceeds that we get from the book or any articles we publish, we're donating them. We don't want to profit from Johnny's death in any way. And that's another good thing, hopefully, that can come out. If we can donate the proceeds to, well, we're thinking now of the Luke Beatty Foundation because it supports both mental health and domestic violence, which were very much, you know, well, what happened with Anna.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we want to do that for the memory, in the memory of Johnny.
Well, thank you so much for doing our podcast. I can understand how your friends, some of your friends probably just caring for you and thinking that we want to take advantage of you and your story. Or, you know, I'm sure they have loving reasons for advising against it. But thank you so much.
A lot of people will hear this.
Yes, definitely. You know,
I think we all know someone whose family is affected by a member with a mental illness.
Yeah, and the broader community needs to know that.
Thank you for hearing our story.
Yeah, thanks so much.
I really wish I could give you a number to call or a website to visit if your family is struggling with similar circumstances to those we've heard about from Mary and Katie, but I can't. All I can do is wish you luck and hope that future governments will better fund mental health care in Australia so that people can receive help before they end up in prison. We'd sincerely like to thank Mary and Katie for telling their difficult story, and again, we'd like to pay respect to the memory of Anna's victim, Johnny Petrovsky. We mentioned an article of Katie's about her sister, and you can read that article on our Facebook page.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review on iTunes and 5 stars. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davarin, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together. We'll be back with more Australian True Crime next week. Until then, stay safe.